This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Mira que somos mortales, arreglemos nuestras cuentas, arreglemos nuestras cuentas. Mira que somos mortales, arreglemos nuestras cuentas, arreglemos nuestras cuentas. Paloma blanca, pecho celeste, la vida aunque me cueste, siempre vivirás conmigo, siempre tú irás conmigo. La vida aunque me cueste, siempre vivirás conmigo, siempre tú irás conmigo.
estación y divertido en la selva. Aquí no hay, en la selva amazónica no hay primavera. En la selva amazónica no hay primavera. En la selva amazónica no hay primavera. En la selva amazónica no hay primavera.
In La Selva Amazonica, no hay primavera. In the Amazon rainforest, there is no spring. Some music from Peru, opening up with here on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Here on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, where my name is Bill Weinberg. That was some chicha music from the Peruvian Amazon. That last cut that we just heard from a disc entitled Chicha Libre, which was brought back from Peru, I believe, for the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, and also for his own listening pleasure, of course, by our good friend Nicholas Kozlov. Shout out to you if you're listening tonight, Nick. And with that wonderful surf guitar riff on Vivaldi's The Four Seasons. Very interesting stuff. Chicha seems to be basically chicha is the dance craze from the Peruvian Amazon. Here, as I can tell, it's basically cumbias with a kind of 60s retro psychedelic feel with a lot of sort of surf guitar and organ and so on going on. Before that, we heard music which I brought back from Peru, many years ago when I was down there. Boy, I wish I could go back. That was from an artist by the name of Jaime Guardia, from an album entitled Sangre Andina, or Andean Blood. And he's, of course, playing the charanga. And singing, we heard two cuts in which he was singing, mostly instrumental, two cuts in which he was singing, the latter of which was entitled Iras Conmiga, or Come With Me, in Spanish, quite obviously. But the first was Purum Yutucha, which is in Quechua. I don't know what Purum Yutucha means in Quechua, because I don't speak Quechua. But if anybody out there is listening who understands Quechua and can tell us what Jaime Guardia was singing about, we'd love to hear from you. Maybe we'll take phone calls later on tonight at 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900. If I can get through all of the information and ranting and announcements that I want to get through in the next 40 minutes, maybe we'll take phone calls for the last half hour of the show, if anybody indeed has anything to say. And I've noted before that when I talk about, this is really sort of an irony, given the theme that we've been on in recent weeks, okay? The theme we've been on in recent weeks of talking about, well, for starters, war crimes and atrocities, such as, unfortunately, are going on in Peru at the moment, and the double standards about them which prevail, both on an international level and here in New York City, and particularly amongst the WBAI community and the greater left scene here in La Manzana Grande. I've noted before that, you know, when I talk about certain issues, when I talk about particularly Palestine, or when I talk about Bosnia, or I talk about Tibet or the Uyghurs, I get vociferous response, passionate response. And very often, people who are implicitly or explicitly defending, for instance, Chinese repression against the Tibetans or the Uyghurs, will call in and say, why don't you talk about the American Indians? Why aren't you concerned with that? And yet, when I do any programming about indigenous struggles in the Western Hemisphere, it does not provoke any kind of engaged, passionate response. And when I open the phone lines for listener phone calls, after having given an update and exegesis on, for instance, the indigenous struggle in Peru or Colombia or Bolivia or Mexico, or indigenous struggles within our own borders here in the United States, there is no response, or else a mere lukewarm response. So why is that? Am I, you know, I'll point out by this irony that, by way of this irony, that the people who invoke indigenous struggles in the Western Hemisphere to say that I should be talking about that instead of talking about Tibet sort of prove through their evident disinterest when I actually talk about indigenous struggles in the Western Hemisphere that they aren't really concerned with indigenous struggles in the Western Hemisphere. They're more interested in letting the Chinese state off the hook for its repression in Tibet. Okay, a little rant there. Now let's actually, now that that's out of the way, there's a few things I'd like to say about Peru. But first, on the theme of what we're going to be discussing tonight, I am once again going to play an announcement for an event hosted by the War Resisters League, which is happening this Thursday. So listen up, y'all. Hello? There we go.
Join the War Resisters League on Thursday, June 11th, for the David Dillinger Lecture on Nonviolence. The keynote speaker, Nicholas Baker, is the author of Human Smoke, The Beginnings of World War II, The End of Civilization, which New York Times Review called an eloquent and passionate assault on the idea that the deliberate targeting of civilians can ever be justified. WRL's lecture on nonviolence honors the memory of revolutionary pacifist and activist David Dillinger. Also on the program is George Hauser, who refused the draft with Dillinger in 1940. Please come to this free program on Thursday, June 11th, 7 p.m. at Judson Memorial Church, 55 Washington Square, South in Manhattan. For more information, the War Resisters League at 212-228-0450. Again, 212-228-0450. Or see www.warresisters.org.
Okay, so one more time, just in case you missed any of that, that is going to be Nicholson Baker, author of the recent controversial book, Human Smoke, The Beginnings of World War II, The End of Civilization, who will be the keynote speaker at the War Resisters League Dave Dillinger Lecture on Nonviolence, which honors Dave Dillinger, a World War II resister, civil rights activist, anti-Vietnam War leader, member of the Chicago Eight, and peace and justice activist until his death at 89. The event, free and open to the public, will be held on Thursday, June 11th at 7 p.m. at Judson Memorial Church in New York City. Judson Memorial Church is on the south side of Washington Square Park, just a couple of blocks to the east of 6th Avenue. So I hope to see you there on this Thursday night at 7 p.m., Judson Memorial Church. And let's see, there's one more announcement, which I have been asked to read. So let me open my email account here. Okay, what's my password again? Don't say your password on the air, Weinberg. That would be a faux pas. Okay. A moment of silence while I input my password. Okay. Right. On the subject of... great. I input my password wrong. Okay, this is bad. This is... right. That's not my password. What's my password? Right. That's my password. Okay, sorry. Very unprofessional, I know. But just bear with me, okay? Okay, here it is. On the subject of... the economic crisis, confronting capitalism's economic crisis. A talk by Andrew Kleiman, who we had on these airwaves, speaking on this very topic back in the fall. He is the author of Reclaiming Marx's Capital, a Refutation of the Myth of Inconsistency. I believe that also there's going to be a talk. Is these happening at the same event? I'm not quite sure if these are... It's a little bit unclear. Tuesday, June 23rd, public meeting. Yeah, I believe it's the same event, right? Andrew Kleiman is going to be speaking on the economic crisis and left responses. And Ann Jacklard is going to be speaking on a new organization for a time of crisis. And this new organization, I believe, is the Marxist Humanist Initiative. Apparently there have been some splits within the Marxist Humanist current. And one of these new organizations to emerge is Marxist Humanist Initiative. So they write, as the worst economic slump since the Great Depression calls into question the viability of the capitalist system, we hope it has, and as people increasingly doubt whether capitalism is desirable or even necessary, boy, do I love to read those words, we need to unite theory with practice and an understanding of the current crisis in order to respond effectively. We invite everyone seriously interested in this task to join us in this seminar series. Participants will be expected to have done the readings prior to each session. Okay, so this is going to be one of those things. Donations are requested, but no one will be turned away. Well, I'm not quite sure if this must be an ongoing... I'll tell you what, probably the best thing is to go to their website, which I believe is MarxistHumanistInitiative.org. and see what they have to say, because I can't quite figure out if this is... the public meeting is going to be Tuesday, June 23rd. There we go. The public meeting is going to be Tuesday, June 23rd. And I believe that's going to kick off the seminar series. Yes, I believe that's what's going on here. So either go to their website, MarxistHumanistInitiative.org, or go to the public meeting, which is going to be Tuesday, June 23rd, which is going to be at 7 p.m. at 44 East 32nd Street. 44 East 32nd Street, 11th floor. So, once again, that's going to be a public meeting to kick off the seminar series at 44 East 32nd Street, 11th floor. And if you want more information, go to MarxistHumanistInitiative.org, and you can get up to speed on Andrew Kleiman's incisive analysis of... What seems to be a very deep crisis of capitalism, if not, we should be so lucky, the final crisis of capitalism. Capitalism is a much more tenacious virus than many of us ever gave it credit for. Anyway, now it's just about 12:30. So let's talk about Peru, because Peru kind of ties together the two themes of the two announcements which I read. First, war crimes and atrocities, which are assuredly going on in Peru right now, although there has not actually been, there isn't actually a state of war, even a civil war, although it seems that things might be escalating in that direction. There have certainly been massacres and atrocities just in the last 4 or 5 days, to which the world has paid very, very little note. And secondly, the world economic crisis and the apparent crisis of capitalism, which has caused most of Latin America to, or actually even before the crisis hit in, most of Latin America had gone over very, very strongly to the left. And, in fact, amazingly so. For long-time followers of the region, it's very, very difficult to believe that, for instance, in Bolivia, which had literally been under the control of Nazis, and I'm not using that in a hyperbolistic sense at all. I'm using it in a very narrow and literal sense. It had been under the control of Nazis two generations ago. I mean, Klaus Barbie, the notorious Butcher of Lyon, was famously the intelligence chief under the Bolivian military dictatorships of the 1970s and early 80s, particularly that of Hugo Banzer. And now there's a left-wing, indigenous-led socialist government in Bolivia. So it's a real cause for optimism, actually. And, of course, there's also Venezuela has gone over quite strongly to the left, Ecuador somewhat strongly to the left, and then somewhat more moderately to the left, Chile, Argentina, and Brazil. So this leaves only three countries which are sort of still in the still beholden to the increasingly discredited model of what's called neoliberalism in Latin America, or called free trade here in the United States, which is, you know, coming more and more into question. And finally, you know, there's been, since the economic crash, there's been more and more of a sense globally that the free trade dogma or neoliberal dogma, which has been in place since the Reagan Revolution in the beginning of the 1980s, all of that is being called into question now. And there's more and more of an assumption that, no, the magic of the market left to its own devices will not take care of everything. And that, in fact, there needs to be a heavy hand of public intervention at the very minimum. And yet, there are still three very significant countries in the Latin American region which hold to the so-called Washington consensus of free trade and eliminating the last vestiges of you know, the populist programs, which instated a certain degree of public control over the workings of the economy. Mexico, Colombia, and Peru. And we've been aware that, you know, in Colombia, there's been this extremely, not coincidentally, right? Colombia is the worst human rights abuser in the Western Hemisphere, far and away, and also the biggest recipient of U.S. aid, particularly military aid, far and away. And there's been this really ugly Plan Colombia program, which has been in place for about 10 years now, in the name of, ostensibly in the name of fighting drugs, but actually that's become extremely mixed up with the counterinsurgency program against the guerrillas, and more to the point, against the civil movements in Peru, although this is not in name or in propaganda, but in reality, against the civil movements in Colombia, against the civil movements in Colombia, which have been defending, you know, campesino and indigenous land rights and demanding a halt to the program of free trade. And Alvaro Uribe, of course, has taken a very, very heavy hand, cracking down on these civil movements in the name of cracking down on the guerrillas and the drug gangs. And Uribe is also a big proponent of the free trade agreement with the United States, which is still pending in Washington's Congress. So now, you know, we find that this model is being, you know, they tried to export this model through a program called the Andean Regional Initiative, which would see similar programs of military aid concomitant with pending free trade agreements being exported to Ecuador, Peru, and Bolivia. Now, since then, Ecuador and Bolivia have sort of broken ranks with the Washington consensus and gone to the gone very strongly to the left. So they're kind of out of the program now. Peru remains the one country which is really in the program. And Peru passed a free trade agreement with the United States 2 years ago. And Peru is still getting substantial U.S. military aid, not nearly as much as Colombia, but it's the second largest recipient in South America of U.S. military aid after Colombia. And then, of course, there's Mexico, which in some ways also sets the template for this whole thing. And now, because, I mean, it was Mexico which, you know, they established the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, which sort of set the template, which they then tried to export to South America through what they were originally calling the Free Trade Area of the Americas, or the FTAA, but they've since, given that the continent has gone over to the left, they've sort of broken it into a piecemeal thing where they passed one in Peru, and now they're trying to pass one in Colombia, and so on. What happened in Mexico, as we're all aware, is that in preparation for the enactment of NAFTA back in 1993, the Mexican government passed a constitutional reform package which called for the privatization of most of the country's industry and resources, and most significantly for the privatization of communally held indigenous and campesino lands. And put in place a mechanism by which the ejidos, or the communally held peasant lands in Mexico, which were a fruit of the insurgency of Emiliano Zapata in the Mexican Revolution of 1910 to 1917, for the ejidos could be privatized and sold off to the highest bidder by a vote of the ejidatarios, or the members of the collective. And in reality, of course, the ejidos had already sort of under the rule of of the corrupt one-party state in Mexico, the ejidos had already sort of degenerated into these corrupt little autocracies. So votes, it was quite evident, would be bought through, you know, intimidation, fraud, terror, bribery, etc., and that the campesinos would be pushed from their ancestral lands. And it was predicted at the time that there would be a tremendous influx of refugees, of former campesinos who had been expropriated of their traditional lands, to the maquiladora zones and to the shanty towns and the slums around Mexico City and Guadalajara and the big border cities like Juarez and Tijuana and so on, and ultimately a big influx into the United States. And of course, all of that has come to pass and has sparked, you know, the whole xenophobic backlash and militarization of the border zone within this country and so on. A one significant and unforeseen development of this program of privatizing the communal lands was the Zapatista uprising of January 1st, 1994, which was the exact moment that the North American Free Trade Agreement took effect. The Maya Indians took up arms in Chiapas, the southernmost state in Mexico, and they still, despite significant reversals in recent years, control much of Chiapas as an autonomous zone, and their struggle has been emulated by indigenous peoples and campesinos across Mexico, who have similarly declared their own autonomous zones, and there have been other armed indigenous rebel movements which have taken up arms, and so on. And now, well, unfortunately, another result of the expropriation of the peasants from their traditional niche in the economy in Mexico has been that more and more of them have been forced into the narco economy. On account of this, there's been this huge explosion of this sector, albeit illegal sector, in Mexico, and an increasingly violent struggle for control of the narco trade. And now, lo and behold, the United States government, just after having, you know, sort of exported the NAFTA model to South America, now they're exporting the Plan Colombia model to Mexico. After exporting the NAFTA model from Mexico to Colombia and Peru and so on, now they've imported the Plan Colombia model from Colombia to Mexico, and instated what they're calling Merida Initiative, which the critics call Plan Mexico, which is this huge package of military aid for Mexico, once again in the name of fighting the narco gangs. But we can be sure that this beefed-up military prowess is also going to be used against the social movements in Mexico as well. So, and now we have the same situation appears to be playing itself out in Peru. It's like deja vu all over again. In preparation for the free trade agreement with the United States taking effect, the Peruvian Congress has passed a series of laws which call for the privatization of communally held indigenous lands, overwhelmingly in the Amazon rainforest of Peru, where there's a lot of oil, very little of it has actually been exploited, and they have now President Alan Garcia has drawn up plans which call for opening 75% of the Peruvian Amazon to oil exploitation, and the obstacle to this has been that most of these lands have been either under the control of communally held by indigenous groups which inhabit them, very traditional hunter-gatherer type indigenous groups, or have been officially protected areas under a forestry heritage program as it's officially known. And the large areas which are not, which don't fall under either of those two forms of protection, actually harbor uncontacted tribes, so to speak. That's actually an imprecise phrase. And the indigenous activists actually use the phrase peoples who are in voluntary isolation. Because it's not like these tribes have no contact with the outside world. They know all too well that industrial civilization is encroaching upon them, and they don't want contact with it. And they retreat deeper into the rainforest to maintain their own self-sufficient lifestyle and avoid contact with the outside world. So their allies amongst indigenous groups which have been contacted and understand that contact with the outside world opens the door to rapid cultural erosion and to disease and loss of land and loss of sovereignty, are petitioning the Peruvian government to put many of the unprotected areas of the Amazon rainforest under special reserves, which should be created for the protection of uncontacted peoples or peoples in voluntary isolation. So not only has the Garcia administration been completely intransigent on this demand, but now it is actively trying to roll back the two levels of protection which already exist on the rainforest. And the first of these is very, very closely paralleling what we had, what we saw in the prelude to NAFTA in Mexico. Now the difference is, of course, that most of the communally held lands in Mexico, you know, were not in the rainforest because Mexico doesn't have very much rainforest. It's got one little sliver of rainforest in Chiapas called the Lacandon Selva, which is along the border with Guatemala, which is now largely under the control of the Zapatistas. But that's just compared to the Amazon rainforest, that's just a very, very, very small little strip of jungle indeed. And it doesn't, constitute more than perhaps 1% of the entire Mexican national territory, whereas the Amazon rainforest is about 33%, about a third of the or more of the Peruvian national territory. So we're talking about vast, vast, vast areas here. But the bureaucratic mechanism is fairly similar, where these lands have the past 25 years or so, not as long as in Mexico, but for the past generation or so, these lands have been legally under the control of the indigenous groups which inhabit them, for the most part, not all of them, of course, but the indigenous groups which are in contact, so to speak, with the outside world, and have got enough of a means of making their presence felt at the level of government in Lima that they're able to have a little bit of political elbow room. They have managed to get their lands titled to them, just as the ejidos are titled to the campesinos in Mexico. So traditionally, these communal lands cannot be dissolved or privatized except by a two-thirds vote of the people who inhabit them. And under the law, which has been pushed through by Alan Garcia, that's now changed to a mere simple majority vote. And also there are questions as to who actually gets to vote. Because is it the indigenous people who inhabit the land, who, speak the indigenous language and have the indigenous culture and engage in the indigenous modes of sustenance, hunting, gathering, and small-scale subsistence agriculture? Or does it also include settlers who could very easily be bought off by the timber interest and the oil interest and so on? So this is the first law which they're opposing. The second law which they're opposing would affects the other level of protection on the rainforest, the so-called Forest Heritage Program, and they would simply take the vast majority of lands which are protected by that program out of that state of protection and open them up mostly to oil exploitation. So, in response to this, the well, they've been waging a struggle in the courts and in Congress. And they do have a few allies in Congress, the indigenous peoples do. And in fact, these laws have been declared unconstitutional, and Congress is supposed to rewrite them and vote on them again. And Garcia has basically been holding that up through his block in Congress. And in response to this, since April, the indigenous inhabitants of the Amazon in Peru have been blockading the roads, blockading the rivers, because very often there aren't any roads and all traffic is on the rivers, and seizing the oil pipelines, seizing the hydroelectric dams, and so on. And they've been armed with spears and machetes and bows and arrows, not largely with firearms. And there's been a certain degree of repression, but it really reached a peak on Friday morning when the Peruvian National Police, backed up by army troops, were sent in to attack a road blockade at a place called Bagua by the Awajun and Wambis indigenous peoples. And by the time it was over, 25 were dead. Overwhelmingly, indigenous protesters, although a few, I believe something like, let's see how many we got here. I believe something like five of them were police, but overwhelmingly indigenous protesters, because, you know, they were armed with spears and so on. They did fight back once it became clear that they were being fired upon by the police. And the situation has only escalated since then. Then now throughout the region, indigenous peoples armed with, once again, armed with spears and machetes and so on, have, been, seizing roads, and there's been more violence taking place, and, more people have been killed, in similar confrontations. The exact details are a little bit sketchy. Of course, as you can imagine, the indigenous organizations, which are leading the resistance movement, and the government, are at odds with each other as to exactly what the facts are. But it appears that 20 national police agents are now dead, out of a total of 60 dead, the rest presumably being indigenous people. And a state of emergency has been declared across the Peruvian Amazon, particularly in the northern part of the Peruvian Amazon where this has taken place, Amazonas Department. And on Sunday, a day of national mourning was declared for the police agents who were killed. Not, mind you, for the indigenous peoples who were killed. Alan Garcia has, in addition to the President Alan Garcia, in addition to declaring a state of emergency throughout the Amazon, he has also issued orders of arrest for the leaders of the movement. In particular, for the leader of the indigenous organization IDASEP, which is the alliance, the inter-ethnic alliance for the development of the Peruvian rainforest, IDASEP. Its leaders have now been, particularly Alberto Pizango, who is believed to be in hiding or possibly has fled to Bolivia. There has been an order issued for his arrest on charges of subversion and inciting the violence and so on. Garcia is comparing the tactics of the indigenous peoples to those of the Shining Path Gorillas, and also implying that there is a Bolivian hand in inciting the unrest, and saying that there's foreign subversion going on. So this is a very, very ominous situation, only likely to escalate. I wish people were paying more attention to it. There are a few glimmers of hope here. A few glimmers of hope. One is that very significantly, I opened up the musical set first with music from the highlands of Peru, and then with some music from the first from the Andean region, the highlands, and then with some music from the lowland Amazon, because here's the real glimmer of hope, is that there's been some real unity which has emerged here between these two regions, which have been frequently pitted against one another in Peru, even sort of the grassroots pitted against the grassroots, particularly under the sort of populist left-wing dictatorship, the Velasco dictatorship in Peru back in the 1970s, when there was the first big thrust of oil development. It was all put in, then it was under state auspices before it was all privatized, and it was sort of put in populist terms of, the advancement of the nation and jobs and so on. Well, Garcia still uses some of that rhetoric, but it's more transparent than ever, because now it's all about, private corporations getting their big piece of the pie, and it's all being done in the name of the free trade agreement. Now it's not really playing with the Peruvian proletariat. And in fact, the largest labor confederation in Peru, the General Confederation of Peruvian Workers, or the CGTP, has held a one-day general strike. I'm sorry, two-day, 48-hour general strike late last month in solidarity with the resistance movement of the indigenous peoples in the Amazon. And pretty much, brought at least Lima to a standstill for 2 days, and much of the other cities in the country as well. And since the escalation over the past 4 or 5 days of violence in the Amazon, they have been protesting it and threatening once more to call a general strike and bring the country to a standstill. So this is a very, very significant glimmer of hope of actually, building some unity between the highlands and the Ladino and Quechua peoples of the coast and the Andes, with the traditionally very, very isolated indigenous peoples of the Peruvian Amazon, the Ashan Inca and others. So it should be said that here we'll take phone calls in just a few minutes if anybody wants to weigh in on any of this. 212-209-2900 is the number. 212-209-2900 is the number. Now, I applaud that the edition of Informativo, the news segment in Spanish that we just heard before the show began, had in-depth coverage of the situation in Peru. I was a little bit less happy to respectfully dissent from my good comrades at the WBAI News that there was a bit plugging an upcoming event from Revolution Books, which is run, of course, as many of our listeners are aware, by the Revolutionary Communist Party, or the RCP, which is an extremely doctrinaire Maoist sect, which has been the big stateside cheerleader for the Shining Path rebels in Peru, who were a pretty bloodthirsty lot. And here's the particular irony of Alan Garcia saying that the indigenous protesters in the Amazon now are, emulating the tactics of the Shining Path, is that these very same indigenous protesters who are now standing up to the Peruvian National Police and Army with their spears and machetes and bows and arrows, just 10 years ago were using their spears and machetes and bows and arrows against the Shining Path. There was a huge wave of repression against the Shining Path under Alberto Fujimori in the 1980s, from their heartland in the highlands in the Andes, and they were largely crushed. The remnant factions which survived fled into the Amazon rainforest, where the government of Peru had very, very little presence at that time. Still does have comparatively little presence, although that's changing fast with the militarization of the region and road building and oil contracts and so on, which is what this movement is all about. But once they got into the rainforest, they sort of now here's the real irony of the situation: is most of the Shining Path were themselves indigenous people. They were Quechua people from the Peruvian highlands. But there was this ideology which was shared both by the Shining Path and by the left-wing sort of populist Velasco dictatorship of the in Peru in the 1970s, that the highland Indians, the Quechua Indians, aren't really Indians. They are Peruvian campesinos because, of course, they constitute the big majority of the Peruvian populace. Or I'm not quite sure if they're depends on how you count, because this is it's an ill-defined category by the most narrow definition. The indigenous are only those who actually speak Quechua. So by that count, it might be around 40% of the populace of Peru. But those who, perhaps, their grandparents spoke Quechua, but, they don't speak it anymore. Because in order to get along in an economy increasingly dominated by Ladinos, that is to say Spanish speakers, they let the language fall into disuse, didn't get passed on to the new generation. Well, are they still indigenous or not? Are they still Quechua or not? Some people would argue yes, some people would argue no. But there was this ideology of both the Velasco dictatorship and the Shining Path that, in fact, they were not, and that they were campesinos who needed to be proletarianized, so to speak, in order for there to really be a working-class revolution in Peru. So the Shining Path was sort of an anti-indigenous movement. And when the Shining Path refugees from the Fujimori repression in the 1980s fled into the Amazon rainforest between 10 and 15 years ago, the indigenous peoples who they encountered there, who were extremely traditional, still, living hunting-gathering lifestyles, had very little contact with the outside world, didn't speak Spanish or Quechua, spoke their own indigenous languages, Ashaninka, and so on. The Shining Path basically saw them as reactionary and backward and counter-revolutionary, and slaughtered them and enslaved them. And this led to a war in the jungle, which very, very little of the outside world was aware of, between the Shining Path and these indigenous groups, once again armed with their spears and bows and arrows, who beat back the Shining Path and reclaimed their territory without any aid from the government. And now they're using, once again, they're standing up to that same government with those same spears and bows and arrows, once again in defense of their land. So it's 1 o'clock in the morning on listener-supported, non-commercial, WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Listener-supported, non-commercial, WBAI 99.5 FM. I just said that, didn't I? Right. My name is Bill Weinberg. That's what I forgot to say. And if people have anything to say, if they want to weigh in on this, we'd be happy to take phone calls at 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900. I was in Peru in 2003 when the indigenous movement, which we're seeing now, was just beginning to organize, when the free trade agreement was being negotiated and the indigenous movement in the rainforest was just beginning to organize. I met with their leaders. I interviewed their leaders. I wrote about it. Much of this reportage is on my website, World War IV Report. You can find it there. So I'm not speaking arbitrarily here. So we actually do a few phone calls, which I am heartened to hear. So let's see what people have to say. WBAI, you're on the air. WBAI, you're on the air. WBAI, you're on the air. You're on the air.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Yeah, like this. I don't understand exactly. If somebody has a lot of money involved in these rainforests, so I don't get why they shouldn't just cut down the rainforest and take the money.
I'm sorry. I'm not quite following your question.
I'm saying you're getting all worried about these rainforests, but see, it's all being done legally, and there's people who
want. No, it's not being done legally. Where'd you get the idea it's being done legally? You weren't listening very carefully. Why don't you listen? The Peruvian Congress has already determined that the laws, which were initially passed under special authorization by President Alan Garcia to push through laws by decree, as it were, in preparation for the free trade agreement, and then Congress would only retroactively get to vote on whether the laws passed constitutional muster. Well, in fact, Congress found that no, they didn't pass constitutional muster, that the laws violate the Peruvian Constitution. And they're trying to have the laws once again re-argued and brought before the floor of the Peruvian Congress to be reformulated, and Garcia's bloc in Congress has been holding it up. So this does not sound like legality to me.
It's going through the process of law, and that's all Congress's work. The United States Congress works the same exact way. Everyone has their own block, everyone has their own interests, and everyone tries to get what they want done. Is that not correct?
Well, yes, but at the moment, those laws have been declared unconstitutional. So what you're stating is simply wrong.
100%. That's why they shouldn't be done now. But when they get declared again constitutional, I don't see what's wrong with someone wanting them to keep those laws in place simply because they...
Okay, so you feel that the indigenous peoples of the rainforest have absolutely no rights whatsoever. So, in other words, you would support it if I came into your home and burglarized you in the middle of the night and took away all of your resources. Took away all of your furniture and your stereo and your computer.
No, I don't really have a computer. But what I'm saying is that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that they should go through the law and try to go and do what they did, which is try to get them to the courts to say it's unconstitutional, as opposed to picking up their bows and arrows and spears to go and fighting. I don't think that it's in the process of the law to go and take your bows and spears and start shooting policemen and killing policemen. I think it was...
I'm sorry. The police fired first. I believe the indigenous account. The police fired on them. They were nonviolently blockading the roads. They were armed for self-defense, but they did not begin the violence. It was the police who began the violence. And they only resorted to... There was this whole thing also happened last August. The same exact thing had gone on last August. And then in response to the wave of protest, the laws were about to take effect last August. And in response to the wave of protest, the Peruvian Congress agreed to have the laws looked at again, and they were declared unconstitutional. And now, in response to that, last August, in response to that agreement, the Indians called off the protests. So now the Indians began the protest again back in April because Garcia's bloc in Congress has been holding up, you know, filibustering essentially the process of reformulating the laws. So I believe you should take a closer look at the situation before you mouth off. WBAI, you're on the air. Turn down your radio and speak up. Although, you know, I appreciate the last caller actually giving us some right-wing dogma instead of the usual tiresome left-wing dogma that we get around here. WBAI, you're on the air.
No, I think that's essentially the problem. is that people don't understand the issue here. And the struggle is for independence for the indigenous people there. Once they become part of the system, and then they become low-level wage slaves, they're no longer independent. I think that's the problem that people have in understanding what the issue is. The last caller was really instructive. He was really confused.
I certainly agree that he was confused, and I agree with your basic sentiment. I would only warn against using the word independence, because that can be taken to mean actual political independence.
No. I'm talking about owning the land, having the land, and producing your own food.
Autonomy,
yes.
Frequently the charge of separatism is leveled against indigenous peoples who are fighting for their own autonomy, and that is not what the indigenous movements in the Peruvian Amazon are about.
Yeah.
They don't want an independent state. They want to be left in peace.
Yeah, I'm thinking in terms of, well, you mentioned the campesinos and the indigenous people, the difficulties in categorizing them.
In Peru, it gets confusing, actually.
Yeah, well, you see, you have the problem here of the Puerto Rican Jíbaro, and you have the New Yorkicans.
Right.
There's a cultural difference. I mean, they can't communicate with each other. A great deal of enculturation has gone on between the New Yorkicans and the Puerto Rican Jíbaros.
Right, but many New Yorkicans are starting to reclaim their Taíno or Jíbaro heritage now.
Not too many.
Yeah, but some.
I think the majority have been so enculturated that they're moving on into becoming completely, part of the system.
Yeah, but I mean, there is a sort of a Taíno cultural revival which is going on.
At a very tiny level, from my experience.
But yeah, but more than 10 years ago.
I know, but you know, the people that I've met, essentially, you know, like, I couldn't communicate with them. It was very difficult because, I mean, in terms of their goal in the future, they didn't seem to have much of a plan for future development.
Well, I mean, you know, it's difficult. A lot of the Taíno culture survives in the Jíbaro traditions of agriculture and so on, but the Taíno language has largely, although not completely, been exterminated, is my understanding. So, you know, it's difficult.
Yeah, is anyone documenting what's going on in Peru? Oh,
yes, certainly people
are. Is there film documentation?
I would imagine so, yes.
Well, it should be out in the public. I think
it certainly should.
The problem is.
It certainly should.
Because I know I remember from anthropology watching all the films, and so I'm more or less familiar with what's going on in that part. I mean, I studied anthropology back in the 70s, so I mean, the problem wasn't as severe as it is now, but I knew that it was coming.
Well, I have comprehensive reports on my website, so if you're interested, you can read about them there.
Okay. Well, I don't have a computer. I can't afford it.
Oh. Wow, you're the second caller who doesn't have a computer.
Yeah.
Very good. That's actually somewhat refreshing. Thank you for your call.
Yeah, thank you for bringing the issue to the public.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye. WBAI, you're on the air. Turn down your radio.
Hey.
WBAI, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello.
Hello.
You stated you went there in about 2003.
Yeah, that was the year.
Remember, what's her name, Miss Berenson?
Yeah, Lori Berenson, yeah.
She went, she goes there, she claims she was there for research, but the government convicted her of aiding the Shining Path.
No, they didn't.
What was she convicted of?
Of aiding the MRTA, which is the Tupac Amaru Revolutionary Movement, another guerrilla group, not the Shining Path.
Yeah, right.
Not the Shining Path.
This was after the Shining Path was so-called disappeared, you know, just dissolved or what?
It was in the tail end of the Shining Path insurgency, yeah.
This was about 2000?
More or less. It's all online. It's kind of peripheral to what we're discussing tonight.
What did she get, like 20 years or
something like that? She's still in prison, and she's pregnant, I understand.
What do you think the situation? You think she was actually a sympathizer with the? She actually went down there to join them.
She was certain. It seems pretty clear she was a sympathizer of the MRTA.
Mm.
I have no idea whether she was actually guilty of what she was charged with.
Yeah, well, that type of situation. I mean, you know, the government doesn't draw too many nuances, you know.
Does not appear that she got a fair trial. But again, rather peripheral to what we're discussing tonight.
Her parents were, they insisted, what do you expect?
Okay, we're going to move on.
Would you say going down there was foolish?
What, on her part?
Yeah.
I'm not in any position to judge. We're going to move on. I keep saying it's not what we're talking about tonight. Thank you for your call. WBAI, you're on the air. You're on the air.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, is this Bill from WBAI?
Yes, it is Bill from WBAI.
Hi, how are you? I'm just calling because I was listening to you, and I just wanted to say that I think it's so great that you're talking about this, even if it's really late at night. Just because I think it's a really important subject, and I think maybe people don't listen enough about it or don't care enough about it, you know, especially what's going on in Latin America. I am from Bolivia, and I just wanted to say just a few things about what you were saying. I just feel like a lot of these indigenous groups, a lot of the times are... Though they might have just causes, they don't always, they're always, sometimes they're just not led in the right way. And I feel, at least in Bolivia, a lot of the indigenous groups just sort of follow the strongest lead, which might not always be the most peaceful or the best one.
Yeah, well, I'm not quite sure what you mean. I mean, what's happening in Bolivia has been largely through peaceful and legitimate democratic channels.
That's a part of the problem that I think people, like foreigners don't really have they have a very different perspective, right? Because if I was in Bolivia, I think it would be, you know, great. Like, all the things that are happening in Bolivia would sound great from here, you know?
Oh, what are your trepidations?
Excuse me?
What are your misgivings about?
I think just in general, you know, 70% of the population is under a really, you know, poverty, you know? Really,
yes.
Really poor.
Yes.
And then you have uneducated people, like 70% uneducated, and then you have really this curse, which is just so racial, you know.
Certainly.
Racial.
Yeah.
And then instead of creating unity, it just creates. I mean, at least in Bolivia, it's just creating a lot of separation, you know. And then to be honest with you, I would actually not be surprised to know that Bolivia might have been affecting all the Peruvian things that have been going on with the indigenous conflict. I mean, it does sound really familiar, doesn't it?
No, how does it sound familiar?
I mean, you have all these indigenous groups that, you know, fight. I mean, I understand what you're saying, that they use their spears, but I think in a way you're sort of romanticizing it I'm obviously with indigenous, right? But I feel like a lot of the times their leaders have sort of hidden agendas.
Okay, like what?
Like, for example, you know, Evo Morales in Bolivia. I mean, I'm just, you know, sort of giving you my interpretation of this, right? And I'm not completely sure, but this is just what I think. For example, in Bolivia, Evo Morales, he's been funded by so many ONGs, which might be linked to George Soros.
Okay, so where's the hidden agenda?
The hidden agenda is that, for example, this is just a theory I read, okay? But, for example, the hidden agenda here is that in 2003, when Bolivia had to, you know, there was a big deal of where our gas was going to go, through Peru or through Chile, right? And instead of, you know, making a decision about either or, we didn't end up exporting at all. It had to come to California. And then apparently, like, George Soros was supposed to be, you know, like, his companies were providing instead of the Bolivian companies. in Russia. You know,
I never heard this. I never heard that. You know, it's very interesting. It's always the George Soros bugaboo, whether, you know, as in this instance, a voice more to the right is trying to discredit the left. It's, oh, they're funded by George Soros. And whenever, you know, somebody on the dogmatic and doctrinaire end of the left wants to discredit, indigenous descent in China or the ex-Soviet republics or whatnot, then it's, oh, they're funded by George Soros. Always for George Soros, bugaboo.
And it's ridiculous to talk about indigenous descent in Latin America because everybody's mixed up. It's just like...
The indigenous peoples in the Peruvian Amazon who are defending their lands now are definitely not. They're not mixed up. They've been living until very, very recently in almost complete isolation from the outside world. And in fact, the Quechuas in the highlands, you know, despite the fact that, they've suffered a certain degree of cultural erosion and so on, they aren't really mixed up either. You know, to say that the word indigenous doesn't have any meaning, because everybody's mixed up is really, you're really in denial to say that, I'm afraid.
And this is the thing, you're telling me I'm in denial. You know, like my grandma is Indian. She didn't speak Spanish. You know, it's ridiculous, you know, and that's what I'm saying. Like, I feel like foreigners just get.
Well, hang on a minute. You know, my grandma was Italian and she didn't speak English either. Okay, and her people had been living on the land up in the mountains in Italy since time immemorial. Okay, but that doesn't mean, you know, but. You know, I am not, you know, because I'm a mix of Italian and Polish and German and Jewish and other things, right? So I acknowledge I am all mixed up. Without a doubt, I'm a mutt. But my grandmother was not. You know, my grandmother was not a mutt. My grandmother was an Italian peasant through and through. So the fact that you're, you know, mixed up, as you say, doesn't, you know, you have to acknowledge that, you know, your grandmother wasn't. If your grandmother actually spoke Aymara or Quechua, she was not mixed up. And there are lots of other people in your country and elsewhere in Latin America who are not mixed up.
Of course there's people that are not mixed up, but I would say that about 60%, at least in Bolivia, you know, from the census, it's mixed up, you know? And then I do have a question for you. You use this term Latinos for Spanish descent?
Yeah.
I mean, can you just explain me what do you identify as Latino, especially in South America?
Well, I mean, that's the general word, isn't it? I mean, Ladino with a D is the general word for someone who speaks Spanish, in contradistinction to an indígena, which is someone whose primary language is not Spanish, but an indigenous tongue.
But you were saying something like it has to do with Spanish descent.
No, it has to do more with...
You were just talking about more of a language thing.
Yes, more of a language thing than a question of descent.
Okay, I mean, I'm just calling just to say that I appreciate that you're you know, bringing attention to the matter, because I think it's extremely important. But I think a lot of the times, you know, especially when you use racial, you know, discourse, it's just...
I'm not using racial discourse.
But I think, like...
I deny that. Well, thanks for your call. We've got to move on. We've got a few more calls and only 10 more minutes.
Thank you.
But thanks for your call. I appreciate it. WBAI, you're on the air. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello.
Hello.
Like this. First of all, I want to get back on topic since we got a little off topic recently. Hello?
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Speak.
First of all, I want to congratulate the first two callers for not having computers. I think that's a nowadays society. I think it's a great thing. And also, I wanted to say like this, that I think that they should have the same type of, like, fight as they had in South America with, like, Nelson Mandela, where they actually did not go and do actual fighting back. I think a more peaceful approach would be necessary. And also, that's the first point. And second of all, I think that once we're talking about this, would you say that, let's say they would take away the land, they should give back the land, correct? So therefore, I think by the same process of logic, we should also give back all the lands we took from the Indians, because we also took the lands from the Indians, so I think we should give all the land back to the Indians.
Well, I'm all for honoring treaty commitments with the American Indians, and I'm also, you know, all for nonviolent resistance. I will, however, point out that Nelson Mandela cut his deal for the peaceful dismantling of the apartheid system after 30 years of African National Congress guerrilla struggle. So I wouldn't be too glib about preaching nonviolence to the oppressed. Let's see if we can squeeze in a few more calls. WBAI, you're on the air. Turn down your radio, please. You're on the air. Turn down your radio, please. You're on the air.
Okay, I did.
Speak.
I was listening to your program on the Bolivian girls. I am from Latin America, from Argentina, but I organized a group for the Ecuadorian Amazon. And I can't tell you how racist are the white people in these countries. They are the minority in Guatemala, in Peru, in Bolivia, and Paraguay, where they think that the indigenous doesn't have right to live in their land. And what happened now in Peru is the same story. The Peruvian people are very racist. The white people, or...
Well, I wouldn't paint with too broad a brush, because after all, the General Confederation of Peruvian Workers, VCGTP, held a two-day general strike in solidarity with the indigenous movement in the Amazon.
Yeah, but in general, the society is very racist.
Well, yes, there certainly is a legacy of racism, which is at
exactly.
work here, quite obviously, of course.
Exactly. So... what happened right now in Peru, I suppose for a certain group, but not the majority of the Peruvian people who are not indigenous. And unfortunately, when I worked for the Ecuadorian Amazon, and then we worked together with the Brazilian people for the Ecuadorian, the Brazilian, in Ecuador, the constitution doesn't recognize the rights of the indigenous for the surface, but not deep. So if the government finds oil, belongs to the government, and the indigenous has nothing to do with that. They don't have any rights in that land. So they suffer a lot of malnutrition, all the same, because Conoco in that time I talked in 91, I worked together with Judith Kimmerlin, a lawyer from
Harvard. Yeah.
Okay, and we worked together. She worked there and I work here. And if you talk to her, she can tell you.
Yes, I know. I have spoken to her.
Are the people there? Yeah. I hear, because I work with the Ecuadorian people here in New York.
All right, so what do you think of Rafael Correa?
Come see, come sa. I don't trust too much all these new leaders.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I am from Argentina, and the people talk about Kirchner, but Kirchner is not from the left. He's not a revolutionary president. He's very corrupt. And the people,
I think Correa is somewhat further to the left than Kirchner, no?
Yeah, a little more. Yeah. Not too much.
Okay. All right, thank you for your call.
You are welcome.
Okay.
Bye.
WBAI, you're on the air. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I don't understand if they're cutting down the rainforest, right? Obviously, they know all the stuff we're talking about and all the reasons why they shouldn't be cutting it down, and still they decided to cut it down. Obviously, it's because they have better reasons to cut it down. So why the heck are we discussing it? They know better than us because they have a lot more people discussing it.
Who knows better? Who knows better than us? The oil companies?
Yeah, because it boils down to money. And since they have the power, nothing we can do about it.
Oh, there's nothing we can do about it. Fine. That's real. That's showing a lot of solidarity with the indigenous peoples of Peru. There's nothing we can do about it. Thanks. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello. Turn down your radio and speak up.
Oh, done.
I can't hold on too long. We're almost out of time. Speak up.
Yes.
Yeah, speak up.
You know you're a nigger lover.
Yeah, that's just charming. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yes, I just want to compliment you on the beautifully crafted program. I'm proud of you. I loved your show. May I make a suggestion? Would you know you might be to do a program on the indigenous people of Cuba?
Ha, ha, ha. There is a really interesting thing.
Yeah.
If I could get back in touch, if anybody has got a line to my old friend Jose Barriero, formerly of Cornell University and now of the Smithsonian Institution, he's a real expert on that, and I would love to get him on these airwaves. So,
great show.
Maybe we'll do
great
that
show.
One day.
I mean, yeah. I learned so much. Great show.
Thank you very
great,
much.
And I wish they put you in the daytime. Great show.
Don't
great show,
don't
great
hold
show.
Your breath.
Great show. Love you.
Thank you very much.
And keep fighting, sir.
Thank
keep
you.
Keep fighting this. And this is Dave from Astoria.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Okay. WBAI, you're on the air. Make it real quick. We don't have much time. WBAI, you're on the air. Make it real quick. We don't have much time. WBAI, you're on the air. Make it real quick. Okay, maybe this is it. Maybe we're finished. Are we finished? I think probably we're finished. Are we finished? Are we finished? Hello?
Hello, hello.
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 Quick, you're on the air.
Hello, hello. Yes, I just like to say I really love your program. I'm just not sure why they gave you a radio show.
You really love my program, but you're not sure why they gave me a program. That's interesting. WBAI, you're on the air real quick.
McQueen.
WBAI, you're on the air real quick. There's a quick one on my head.
You're a nigga-loving Jew, you nigga-loving...
That's great. Does anybody want to call in so we can end on a good note? I should have quit while I was ahead. All right, I guess we're going to go out on a bad note. All right, there's one call. WBAI, you're on the air. WBAI, you're on the air. Say something intelligent real quick.
Yes, like this. I think we should all go and fight for the indigenous groups. I think we should all go actually down there in solidarity with them. Just like I know that you're Jewish, and in Israel, when they tried to have the evacuation, people went down to the Gaza Strip to go solidarity with them. I think we should all go down in solidarity, pick up our Bolsonaro, and fight for the indigenous.
Well, I admire your passion, but I really think that most of us would merely be in the way if we went down to the Amazon rainforest, and that is not the kind of solidarity with the indigenous peoples down there are asking for. They're not asking for people to come down to the rainforest. They're asking for people to protest at Peruvian consulates and to put pressure on the United States government to put pressure on Peru not to instate these reforms in the name of the free trade agreement. So the work which we have to do in solidarity with Peru is here at home in New York City. So maybe we'll have an update on the situation next week. I want to thank all of you who called in, who had something intelligent to say. And I apologize to you for that small minority of callers who are anti-social morons. But, hey, what can you do, you know? Let's go out with a little bit more music from Peru. Let's hear a little bit more from Sangre Andina by Jaime Guardia y su charango. Stay tuned to listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City, where Tom Whisker and Weaponry is coming up next.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.